listener production.
Hi, this is Paul McIntyre. Welcome to the MI3 Audio Edition. I've been a business journalist for 25 years covering the marketing, media, agency and tech sectors. In this series, we talk to industry leaders about the global and local developments that you need to be across this week. This audio edition is created in conjunction with partners as part of our Market Voice series. Well, we're about to take a dive with two companies into the world of applied econometrics and market mix modelling. It's one of the growth spots in the world of marketing, but as we're about to find out, it's going much deeper across organisations, at least for those with more sophisticated ambitions to shape and optimise strategy and business results. And this conversation is perfect because we have Domino's on one side, which is just starting to deploy Mutinex's SaaS-based MMM engine for Australia and Japan. And on the other, we have Asahi, which is about 4 years into its deployment. What's telling with both these companies is that executive leadership buy-in has been central to market mix modeling, making a meaningful contribution to the business. In the case of Domino's, its high-profile CEO, Don May, is backing the program with plenty of enthusiasm. But the hard yards of deploying it is on one of our panelists today, Blake Rand, Group Digital Strategy Manager at the Pizza Juggernaut. In contrast to Blake and Domino's is Asahi's Group General Manager, Commercial Excellence, Gemma Downey, where SaaS-based MMM has started maybe 4 years ago. There's a lot of pragmatic insights and learning in Gemma's experience rolling out econometrics across Asahi Beverages, and we're going to hear from her on that. Gemma and Blake are joined by Mutinex's CEO, Henry Innes, who is now based in New York, where he's making some fast inroads, landing the Australian platform in big US blue chip brands. We might get a little update from Henry on how the giant US market is taking to a very different approach to econometrics, that is, a near real-time SaaS-based platform which is disrupting the historical approach using humans with quant brains to typically do the work, sometimes with timelines that are 6 months behind the data. So welcome to you all. There's some seriously interesting territory we've got to cover here. To Blake, and Blake, we might start with you first. Why Domino's has embarked on this market mix modeling and econometrics deployment? I think you returned to the business in May last year and it was high on your priority list, I think, then. So why now, Blake? What's the initial use case and what do you hope it will deliver for Domino's? And welcome. Great to have you on.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. It was high on my priority list because when I started back at the business, the brief to me was very much around wanting to have best-in-class measurement and optimization capabilities when it came to media investment. And we had done the MediaMix projects, like classic legacy sort of consulting type model projects in the past in some of our major markets. And whilst those projects delivered a lot of value, they were definitely cumbersome. The feedback loop was long. We're looking at doing a project sort of at best every year or every 2 years. And we saw Mutinex really disrupting that model and solving a lot of those shortfalls and tension points using automation and bringing a platform and SaaS-based approach, which let me pitch internally an always-on approach to MediaMix instead of a project-based approach. And in terms of what we want to deliver, it's pretty clear. We want to deliver the best possible information to our decision makers. You know, whether that's a CMO deciding investment across channels or down to a media buyer specialist level trying to optimize formats within a channel.
Blake, you have done a bit of this before, right? You've done it at Domino's and elsewhere. Your experience there, just elaborate a little bit about the experience that you've had historically and what this means with a sort of a SaaS-based platform. It's quite different, right?
Yeah, I guess the best way that I sort of think about it is a project-based approach to a always-on approach. And, you know, working with consulting vendors, as I said, it could be quite cumbersome. You know, time, each time around, you're having to involve a lot of teams to, you know, provision the data and work with the consulting firms on the modeling. And yeah, to your point earlier, Paul, you know, that was generally a six-month process. And as you said, the data is, we definitely still got value out of it, but it's out of date. A lot of the questions are sort of, you have to wait until the next time around to get a view on it from an econometrics perspective. Whereas now the always-on approach, it just lets us be so much more, I suppose, dynamic and the insights that we can deliver back to the business. And I think it lifts a lot of the pain of, you know, the data provisioning because we set up pipelines and automate what's possible and we build process around what's not. And we're clear with, you know, stakeholders on their responsibilities to be able to contribute what they need to contribute so we can deliver this to the business.
And this bit's interesting because you do have the backing of your group CEO, as I mentioned earlier, and the executive leadership team are in on this. Just tell us how hard that was or easy it was to convince them that this is a good thing to do, a smart thing to do for the business.
Yeah, I think because we had had, you know, exposure to MediaMix, you know, at the most senior level before, it wasn't a foreign concept. It was probably one that just, yeah, as I said, it didn't come around so often. And I think, you know, the cultural alignment between, I think, Mutinex and Domino's was made that quite a lot easier to, I suppose, position the product of an always-on, you know, MMM solution. You know, we pointed out the tension points that Mutinex was disrupting, and that was really attractive to our business. So I think, you know, we definitely had to go on, you know, a journey in terms of getting buy-in from senior executives, but yeah, we did a really good job of that early on, and there's so much excitement and enthusiasm about this internally. And when we're talking about investment decisions and we're talking about media effectiveness and we're talking about pricing, you know, potential pricing decisions, Mutinex is now central to those conversations, which is really great.
What were those tension points? Is that what you mentioned earlier, Blake, the tension points around traditional econometrics, what were they?
Yeah, the slow feedback loop, the work that goes into data ingestion prior, and doing that in like a snapshot project type approach, you don't really get any benefit from the last one every time you're doing it again, especially if you're not using, you know, the same partner to do it. So I think solving that, and they're also incredibly costly as well. So solving, you know, the feedback loop was probably the most attractive thing, but also really easing the tension point of all the data ingestion and data wrangling that needs to be done as well.
Henry, you got a thought here?
In today's media market, like, I think one of the big problems is the media market is changing, and it's certainly changing over like periods of 3 to 6 months. And you've seen that with digital performance, CPM inflation and that sort of thing. So what that means is like a good insight delivered in 6 months is the same as a bad insight delivered on time.
Right.
Because neither is particularly relevant to your current situation.
That's the timing thing, right. And so, Blake, just on that, where are you at in your deployment of the SaaS-based system from Mutinex? How far into the rollout are you?
Yeah, so for Australia and Japan, we're platform live. And for Australia, we've started this year hitting the monthly refresh cadence that we are after. We've still got onboarding work to do for other markets in the group. But yeah, Australia is in a good place and is up and running with the monthly refresh cadence.
So, Gemma, it's probably a good time to bring you in because you've been around this one for a little while, right? Yeah, Asahi's been doing it for at least 4 years. Maybe give us your perspective on where Domino's is at compared to Asahi when it was in the same phase, right? So early, Domino's is early. Asahi's probably 3 years ahead. So what were some of the early use cases for Asahi, and what do you see, what have you learned that Domino's is about to uncover, if you like?
Yeah, look, I think our use cases early on was we essentially implemented a proof of value or proof of concept with one of our brands before scaling across the broader portfolio. But I think picking up on what Blake was saying around building that, I guess, that top-down buy-in, that culture of commercial excellence is so key for us. You know, looking back, we went platform first or tool first, then what are we measuring, then build the culture around actually what success looks like. And I think actually the more successful way to embed something like this is going in reverse, which it sounds like what Blake has done quite successfully. For now, so now, obviously, you know, we've made great inroads in actually now building that alignment and building that cohesion with our senior people all the way through into our teams. But definitely, I think, you know, you've got to really understand what good looks like, what success is, what are the metrics you're going to be looking at consistently, and then what is that enablement piece around the tool?
So what part of the business then drove the move to Mutinex and SaaS-based econometrics here? I guess what you're saying, Gemma, is that some unit did it and then you got the proof points and you tried to convince executive leadership that this is a good thing. That's essentially the process you're talking about?
Yeah, that's right. And don't get me wrong, sometimes, I mean, that works really, really well because the business needs to see, you know, something that's kind of actually demonstrating value back before you sign off on a bigger investment. So definitely was a good approach for us. But I think concurrently, really, it's still building that case for actually getting alignment on what good looks like and being really clear on that. So you don't need to double back, you know, kind of in time. I think other learnings I can talk to as well, you know, the big piece for us was good data, you know, getting good data into the tool. I think making sure that it's structured and organized correctly, error-free, timely, et cetera, was a big learning curve for us, particularly in our business. Obviously, it's a big complex business with multiple brands. The great thing is that working with Henry and his team, we've been able to automate a lot of those processes as well. You know, different APIs and applications have obviously been built through the tool over time, which has made that process a lot more seamless. And I think another big thing really, you know, learning-wise is just not undercooking, operationalizing it. Again, for us, there's multiple brands in the platform. And so again, like making sure that to get scale and to get adoption, you are looking at people, process, as well as platform. And sometimes platform can be the easy part. It's really the people and the process that can take the time and energy.
I just want to go back to the data point for a minute, Gemma. When you talked about good data in and ingesting, what sort of data were you ingesting and how much work was there to get that in shape to actually be useful? Was that a big part of the early job?
It was for us because we weren't doing anything like this. We didn't have a data warehouse and we're obviously pulling impressions data in, media data, but also sales data, and that sales data was somewhat fragmented at the time. So a good thing is actually what this has also done is been a bit of a Trojan horse, if you will, and actually getting more structured and organized and understanding where the pockets of data exist in our business. So we're much more sophisticated with that 4 years on. But essentially that was kind of what we've been looking at. I mean, Henry, you've been on the journey. Any of your experiences or from that field?
For me, it was really interesting. We've been on ourselves from a product perspective. We've had a very like interesting journey on this front. Like I think, Jem, when you and I first started, this data OS didn't exist, right? Like that was like a huge gap. You used to kind of wrangle data as like wherever it was found, mm-hmm. and that's how you'd bring it in. And that was just...
Sorry, Henry, when you say data OS, what do you mean by that for the listener?
So Nutanix has a product called DataOS, which effectively acts as a central tool to ingest and validate and do all of the like normal painful work that you would have to do in these projects. You're normally doing it through that tool with us. Now, that doesn't completely eliminate the complexities of data, right? Like in having to check data and things like that. But in terms of tooling that actually helps you like do this in one place, do it consistently well, know which data's been updated, what any issues are with it, it at least puts that in like a very central place, which if you think about it, most of these projects are like if you're in a kind of a legacy company, you're basically going one of two ways. Either you have to go all in on building a data warehouse, which like good luck getting the data engineering resources to do that in an IT backlog that's crunched, or you have to basically go all in on like doing it via CSVs and stuff like that, which also is just basically impossible. And you're almost certain to have built your first MMM with errors to a degree. And as a result, you know, you're going to have to go back and basically recut that with the provider. And every recut takes 6 weeks, right?
Right.
So like it ends up killing you by death by a thousand cuts. So for us, we ended up having to build tooling in the space to handle this seamlessly for us, both for our own sanity, but also from a product perspective to make data much easier to supply to the main model. Because if you think about like where MMM is going to fall down or go up, it's like, can we do three things really well? Can we supply data quickly and easily? Can we process that data into something meaningful that helps us understand where ROI is and is not? And can we then use that data to make better decisions about ROI? And if you kind of think of the MMM business as being in that business and disrupting those points, that's where it becomes a lot clearer.
Blake, can I just ask, I'm going to go back to Gemma in a tick, but what Gemma talked about in terms of trying to get Asahi's data right, have you had a similar challenge or have you just got a magic wand that's sort of sorted it all out for Mutanix?
I'd say we're fortunate at Domino's that we're quite mature with respect to BI and data warehousing. So that's made some of the, you know, the business data automation a lot more straightforward. There's definitely been, you know, challenges around certain data supply that we still do need to build process around, but that's, you know, sort of media partner based. So yeah, like our internal BI and data integrations team have sort of been key stakeholders for us to help us deliver this project for the business.
Yeah, right. Henry, how many of the companies that you're working with have a real challenge with data and those that are probably a bit like, you know, Domino's? How big a job is this? What do you see across the market in terms of doing this?
It's normally a pretty good sanity check for how data mature a business is, right? And it's actually quite a good, like, you can talk about data strategy all you like. But if you're doing MMM, it's going to test how robust your collection processes and things like that are in any business. So we see that quite a lot. I think it's, you know, it's a range. Most businesses who have done data projects before tend to at least have some muscle around doing that versus businesses that haven't done it before or haven't done anything like this before tend to need to build that muscle. I will say that in the US, again, it goes a step further. Like, you know, in the US market, you're very likely just to like have a snow share or something like that where someone can just switch it on for you and it comes straight to you in a set.
So one of the things you talked about earlier, Gemma, was building a culture and particularly around aligning teams to the right metrics. And this is really, I guess it's quite instructive for everyone really. What changed on the metrics? What was useful? What wasn't? What did you discover in this process?
Yeah, I think the big one really is we actually finally had a source of truth around the impact of marketing and media on sales. You know, that's really what we're looking at. So we're looking at revenue and the impact on revenue. And that's something we didn't have before. And then obviously you kind of, that is one of the things that you're looking at when it comes to your measurement mix. Obviously looking at effectiveness and efficiency measures. We're all very familiar with, I'm sure, on this podcast. But the big turning point for us was actually having a commercial impact metric.
And did that change some of the team's view on what metrics mattered then, right? Because if media metrics can say something, but if it's a business impact that's completely different, it's retraining mindsets, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it can make people feel quite uncomfortable too, you know, because I think the things that potentially that you've looked at before and relied on to tell the story, you know, maybe in this aren't necessarily, you know, the sort of the things that you should be doubling down on in the future. And I think this is what this tool has highlighted. But it's also, I think, forcing really good conversation. It's bringing really good hypotheses to the table for us to test and explore and think about. And I believe like all roads really do need to lead back to ROI. So again, having that as kind of that North Star is really key.
As you got all this data, Gemma, what has shifted in terms of how you deploy, how you activate some of this stuff off the data you've got? What's different about that?
Yeah, you know, it's. I think this one here is it's invited some really good conversation in about the choices we make around our investment and our channel mix. You know, we've been a business that is heavily lent into TV, and I think we were redeploying or shifting our investment to online video, but probably not as fast as we should have been, particularly as what the tool was actually recommending us to do. So that's a big one. So kind of building confidence, I think, in that decision and shifting to online video. I think another one for us is there was questions around the effectiveness of social. Hen, you probably remember like lots of conversation around this, and what this has actually been able to do for us is show that social is in fact the most effective channel. It actually delivers the highest ROIs across the board on average. So I mean, like being able to hold the tension on that as okay, where we should be kind of doubling down. And contrary to that, things like display and kind of other things for us that actually don't necessarily drive the ROIs that we're looking for.
So, Blake, to Gemma's point on aligning teams around the right metrics, has there been some reevaluation there for Domino's so far in your deployment, or is it sort of proving out what some of your assumptions were actually robust? Which way has it gone for you?
I mean, on the metrics, I wouldn't say we're shifting the metrics. Domino's always been very focused on, you know, sales, contribution to sales and ROI. I think we're shifting to a much better methodology and solution to give us those metrics. And so we've had a quick, you know, shift internally to Mutinex being the, you know, the foundation and, as Gemma said earlier, the source of truth for us for understanding that.
So in terms of some of the channel allocations and your understanding of what worked and what didn't, any surprises, Blake, that come through from the model?
Yeah, I think it depends who you ask as to surprises, but I think it's definitely helped us to, you know, recalibrate our understanding of, you know, media effectiveness and, you know, validate some things, debunk other things, and identify, you know, opportunities for, you know, optimization. I mean, I think one key one is letterboxing. You know, flyers in letterboxes, is it's so easy to be branded as, you know, antiquated when there's, you know, more exciting ad products in market, but, you know, we're still seeing, you know, really high commercial impact from that investment.
What do you put that down to? Have you got any thoughts on why that is? Is there less of it, so it's getting cut through in the letterbox? Because it's not necessarily about social. This is analog stuff. This is in the hand, in the mailbox. It's like, it's still working.
Yeah, I think it's probably a couple of things. You know, it's mass distribution, and, you know, we're obviously a mass consumer brand, so we need mass reach and mass distribution like that. And I think as well, it's obviously aligned with our physical distribution, where we have, you know, store footprint, which we obviously have, you know, big coverage in Australia, but those letterbox drops are definitely aligned with physical distribution as well. So the customer's getting it and they obviously have, you know, proximity to a store to be able to purchase.
Any early signs on what you're seeing with search, with video on demand, connected TV, YouTube, FTA, anything coming through on that, Blake, at the moment that's telling you to adjust?
I think we're still seeing that, you know, screen is really important for us. Big screen, whether that's, you know, TV, you know, subscription, video on demand, connected TV, YouTube, those formats are still really, really critical for us. I think there's been some other digital platforms, you know, big digital platforms where we've been a bit more challenged, and probably to your point earlier, you know, some, you know, assumptions of have been challenged in terms of how effective they are for us. But I think it's not necessarily a case of killing those channels. It's an opportunity to improve, you know, the results that we're getting from those channels with some major tweaking and smaller things as well.
So Gemma, can I just ask, how then radically different is, if we talk about it in a media context, a channel context, has your media mix changed radically as a result of, as you've moved in and got better at this, or is it sort of just tweaking around the edges and optimization?
Oh, I would say it's significantly changed, obviously more to, like Blake's comment there, obviously a screens focus. We, you know, particularly some of those other kind of more channel specific examples I gave before, but also not being as, I think the big one really is not being as rigid with our investments and our commitments and actually adopting a more fluid approach to our media. And also equally sort of looking at kind of how we can be more dynamic with our investment across the portfolio, given that we have a number of brands in there. So how can we almost look at kind of the impacts and the sensitivities across the portfolio where we can upweight and downweight, you know, throughout the year.
Got it. Gemma, you sort of talked to a little bit about the broader use case for MMM, but it's not just a marketing tool anymore. That's sort of one of the things that you've sort of working on now and building out, that it actually can go into revenue growth management and beyond. Just to unpack where you want it to go, where it is for you and where it could go.
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, look, I think that's the key piece, is it's not just a marketing tool. I think what you said, it's also like a finance tool. Like it ultimately is supporting you to look at how you maximize your investment across a portfolio, particularly for us. So I think having finance at the table has also been a big part of the embedding of the tool, like getting them to understand the insights that are coming through from that to then support in the conversations about where we are investing our budgets. But then the RGM piece that you mentioned, revenue growth management, we have, you know, definitely an intention of looking at how we can ingest the data from our trade promotion and our trade optimization tools to look at price elasticity. So again, something that we're, again, not currently live doing now, but definitely an ambition that we're going to be looking at over the next few months.
That sort of conversation, I imagine, very much engages the finance team, does it? Because it's where this gets interesting.
Exactly. And I think at the end of the day, also for marketers, yes, the tool can help build muscle around media, creative channel, you know, kind of all of those marketing pillars, but it also does build that commercial muscle too. And I think, as we all know, the best marketers have both. And so that's what it's allowing marketers to have more commercially focused conversations with the finance team.
That's pretty common, Henry, across your client portfolio that happens, or is it in special cases?
I think increasingly marketing and finance is working together. I think that's just a general theme that we're seeing. And to Gemma's point, the best marketers generally have that commercial lens and are bringing that commercial lens. And I think that's definitely something we're seeing as a theme. I think, as you know, obviously financial markets are changing, which has a flow through effect to putting like capital pressure on businesses, particularly businesses that have a, you know, have debt or use debt as working capital, which is very, very common today. So the flow-on effect of that is that, you know, obviously finance and marketing have to work closer together.
Blake, Gemma talked about price elasticity and the impact that this sort of modelling can have on it. That gets pretty interesting for Domino's. Is that on your radar at some stage? Is it a long-term ambition? What can you – it changes the dynamics quite significantly for Domino's, doesn't it, because it's a very price-sensitive.
Yeah, I think earlier on, I talked to validating, you know, some things that we thought and you know, pricing decisions that were made over the past, you know, 12 months and, you know, hypothesis around how that impacted sales and customer counts were, you know, validated through some of the things we were seeing in the tool. But so it's definitely something that is 100% on our radar to continue using the product for, to understand the impact of pricing decisions. And, you know, to the point around aligning this, you know, more with, you know, finance and planning, again, that's something on our radar as well. We really want to not just be retrospective, we want to be forward-looking and use the capabilities you know, that growth OS has to do that. So, and, you know, we're already starting that in Australia, you know, looking at, you know, when we get a starting point for a media plan, we've started to plug that into scenario planning tool with growth OS and try and, you know, optimize the media based on the, you know, the data that's in the platform. So it's already given us a really good steer on how to, you know, plan for campaigns or, you know, quarters or even financial years, which is where we want to get to next with it.
How's the US market going, Henry? What's going on there? Is it different to the Australia and the receptivity of all this? Are they using it and as enthusiastic?
One, in the US market, everybody does MMM. So I think like the market penetration of MMM is much, much higher than in Australia. You are still dealing with the same competitive set, which is, you know, relatively slow legacy consulting companies who are unable to do this work quickly and at a cost scale that makes sense for most businesses. So from that perspective, the US market has the same overall market dynamics. We've won very large blue chip brands in the wagering sector and in the in CPG. So we're very confident that it's a good market now, and it's the right market for us. And those are all household names. I think from our perspective, what's really exciting there is like the media dynamics are slightly different in the sense that media is far more competitive. Like the concept of overbooking on media channels is very, very common over there. Like there's some places where you just cannot buy inventory unless you have like really good agencies to trade it for you and who have their hands on that inventory. So it runs very differently like that. You know, sponsorships are far more competitive. So I think businesses have a slightly different existential question, which is, you know, what can I drop basically? Because in a market where I'm always buying media, I'm always trying to chase the next thing, like knowing, you know, where you perhaps don't have to chase becomes more important. Certainly because the market is so hyper-competitive, the demand for timeliness is much higher. But we don't think that's a bad thing for MMM, given the current market over there is slow MMM still. So that to me feels like very good signs and progress. The final thing I'll just say on it is data maturity is quite interesting over there. Like most businesses tend to be on Snowflake. They tend to be prepping our data in a very sophisticated way. And that's probably not something that we are as used to. And that's been really refreshing working over there with that.
Because the data is already almost structured for you to start to ingest. Is that the point there?
Correct. But that's primarily because they have MMM in place already, right? So like most of them have had it in place for like many, many years. And so really it's a question of trying to switch the data feed over.
Final wrap up from each of the panelists on what next. And we've had a little bit of that, but Gemma, the ambition for the next perhaps 12 to 18 months, where are you headed on this? And ultimately, where would you like to be? What's next for Asahi?
The next is just continuing to double down on these high value use cases. Some that I've mentioned already, looking at the impact of seasonality, looking at the impact of pricing and marketing, you know, really what is that connection between mental and physical availability? We're already seeing, you know, kind of certain brands responding to that and more sensitively, you know, looking at things like the, you know, geography sensitivities and kind of really what are those big cases. But also I think excitingly, Henry, we've been looking at, you know, scenario building. So actually the predictive modeling and functionality. So again, actually helping us get a view across our portfolio about where we should be spending, you know, to, again, across a number of brands to drive impact.
Have you run any tests on that one, Gemma? Or is how interesting and accurate does it get?
We're actually in the middle of a pilot right now, Henry. So we're just been kind of, getting the, getting the functionality sort of right for our business and kind of fit for purpose. And then we're about to kind of roll with it.
Henry, what does a predictive scenario plan look like? How is it applied in a non-beverages sector, for instance, so I don't get in trouble with Gemma?
Well, so previously, the way predictive MMM works is it works kind of going one model or by one model, if that makes sense. And that's been like relatively challenging as you get to larger and larger enterprises with varying degrees of complexity. So, for example, you know, banking, you've got different product lines, right? Like in telcos, you've got like different business units, different product lines, all sorts of things. Like enterprises have a degree of complexity that they have to tie almost multiple plans together to get to the one overall outcome for the overall business. And so I think the current functionality that exists across the market has generally been like predicting on the individual model rather than like a collection of models to start to generate an overall outcome and sense of outcome. So that's what we've built and what we're rolling out at the moment. I think the really exciting thing about that as well, which is something I particularly like, is we're giving customers the ability to save the predictions too. Because I believe any company that's in the business of predictive analytics that does not give functionality to save those predictions so that you can hold them to account is probably lying about how predictive their model is.
So what sort of predictions are you talking about there? That literally, what scenarios?
So you can plan across like a portfolio and go like, I've got this much money for the portfolio, or I can go brand by brand, or I can even go down into like, okay, I want to allocate this much to awareness marketing, this much to consideration-based marketing, this much to conversion marketing. I want to spend a minimum of X in this awareness channel and a maximum of Y in this conversion channel. You can do all of those different things, which allows you to like fully plan a budget in an integrated way across a very complex organization that has both multiple hierarchies and levels to its enterprise, but also multiple levels and layers to its marketing. And that is an incredibly complex thing to do.
Yeah.
At this stage, and there is no simple tool that's out there that allows you to do that easily.
How predictive are you going to get, Blake? And this is, we'll wrap up with you. What's your ambitions on predictability and where you could do it with Domino's? Is that a little bit too far down the track for you at the moment?
Oh, I think we've already sort of started to look at it with the functionality that, you know, Mutinex is offering. And it's a huge, even, you know, now it's still a huge step in the right direction. As I mentioned before, you know, being able to take sort of like a draft media plan and plug it in and go, all right, well, what if I change these things based on, you know, some insights that we've had or some things that, you know, we know, and then, you know, running the simulation to see what the tool, you know, gives you as outputs to steer you in the right direction. We're definitely not at the point of, you know, validating that, but it's pretty exciting just to be, you know, on the journey of bringing that to our planning.
Gemma Downey, Blake Rand, Henry Innes, really super interesting conversation about where the business impact of all this activity is going. So thanks for joining. Stay safe. Thank you.
This MI3 audio edition was presented by Paul McIntyre. That's moi. Producer Nick Slater. Music by Matt Dwyer. For more episodes, go to listener.com or download the Listener app and search MI3 audio edition to listen for free. Listener.